الشيطان العظيم الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين الطيبين.
صلي على محمد وآل محمد.
I hope that all the brothers and sisters have been able to have a wonderful time in this conference. I personally have been enjoying it, and I hope that we're all able to benefit intellectually and spiritually in this conference. Being the last day, I hope you're not all tired for this. I think it's an important topic. It's one that concerns every single one of us in many ways. One of the reasons why the topic, Reclaiming the Sharia, was introduced was what Brother Ali mentioned. There's another reason as well, which is in the description that I got of this topic, and that is the portrayal of the Sharia in the media today is not a very positive one. Whenever you hear a name that is related to a Salafi movement, something that doesn't look good, terrorism, what they call fundamentalism, fanaticism, and so on and so forth, you hear the name Sharia. I haven't recently done any particular research on how many times the word Sharia pops up in the media in America. I haven't seen it as frequently as you find it, say, in Europe, particularly in Britain. There's a lot of talk about that, about the Sharia and the implementation of Sharia law. And it's something that there's fear of. What you hear it generally, globally, in the context of, is the implementation of Sharia law in countries such as Saudi Arabia and the Taliban in Afghanistan. These are areas that you hear the word Sharia, okay, and the implementation of it. It's a very scary thing. When you hear that, you see the image of someone's head being chopped off, or somebody's fingers being chopped off, or women being beaten on. I remember images of that that were, I don't know if it was CNN or BBC. The context is that. So Sharia is something very scary within Islamic teachings. It's one of those areas of the religion that has been used to misrepresent Islam. So I think reclaiming the Sharia, as is the title and the topic that we have, is to reclaim it from those who are misrepresenting it, or those who are not even Muslim and they are misrepresenting it in the media by giving incorrect definitions, inaccurate definitions, or showing dimensions of it and interpreting it in ways where it is unacceptable to display a wrong image of Islam. One thing to say about that before getting into the actual understanding of Sharia and some of these subtopics I have here, and the brothers very thoughtfully put forth to me to discuss, is to realize, brothers and sisters, what is actually going on a grander scale in the media with regards to Islam. And I feel it's important for us to understand it correctly in order to be able to deal with it correctly. What is happening is that with the growth of Islam in America, which according to the statistics, Islam is the fastest growing religion globally, and particularly in the United States of America. All right, this is fact. And when you have Islam on the rise, historically, this is something we find in all religions. Anytime any prophet came to a region, When the authorities of a particular region start realizing that their people that they used to rule over with the wrong ideologies are now being attracted to a new ideology, in order to control them and prevent them from going to that new ideology, they create phobia against it. Okay. And hence, with regards to Islam, there is Islamophobia. And it is something very serious in Western media. The purpose of it is to prevent the non-Muslims from accepting Islam, for there to be phobia, because Islam is the religion of the truth. Islam is the religion of the fitrah, the inner self. It resonates with the soul. If anybody hears, during the time of the Holy Prophet, when the verses were being recited, Arabic verses of the Quran for the Arabs, it was so refreshing to hear those verses, and the kuffar observing this, realized the danger of it, they came up with different methods to prevent people from hearing it. As I said, phobia is one of those. So people don't even look into it, because once they look into it, many people will be attracted. Many people. My mother is a revert, my mother-in-law is a revert. When you talk to them and other reverts to Islam, it's not like somebody had to give them some very complex philosophical argument to accept Islam. They just read the simple, complex, but they have a simple understanding as well, of the verses of the Holy Quran, the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, and they caught on. It's important for us to note that. Why? Because the intention is for Muslims not to be able to express their religion, talk about their religion, and present it in the right way, and be proud about their religion. If we don't understand this correctly, one of the things that happens, and is happening currently, is that Muslims become apologetic. Instead of realizing their strength, instead of realizing that this ideology is so strong that the superpowers of the world are feeling threatened of the ideology, and hence thinking that, okay, this is our strong point, we gotta study it further, we gotta understand it better, we got something, we have jewels that we can present to the world, people start feeling fear within. They don't want to express things, they don't want to be upfront about things, they don't want to show that they are Muslim, they have that fear in themselves. It's important that we remove that, we understand that this religion with the Sharia is a very beautiful religion. It presents solutions for life, which are very important. And I hope we get a better understanding of it and are able to present that to those souls that are ready to hear it. With regards to the Sharia, the first thing I'd like to do is that the term may be a bit unfamiliar, and we may not have heard a good definition of the word Sharia. What is the Sharia? Shara, okay, is basically law. The Sharia, to put it very basically, is Islamic law. From the Salat, to the Sum, to the Hajj, to the transactions and trade, the rules that we have in Islam. And then it gets to the social political arena as well. Rules that are related to government, the penal law of Islam. We have a very systemized penal law in Islam, and that's one of the areas that there's a lot of focus on, there's a lot of fear created based on. That whole system is something that is referred to as a Sharia. The other thing that I'd like to mention with regards to this, with regards to the Sharia, is this being a phobia that is created and misrepresentation, for example, as I mentioned, showing images of some of the punishments that you find in Saudi Arabia or you would have found during the Taliban's time in Afghanistan. We have to make sure that we have a correct understanding of what the legal system of Islam is. A lot of us are very unfamiliar with the legal system of Islam. And not having that proper knowledge of the Sharia creates a lot of questions and doubts in people's minds, and people question the legitimacy of Islamic law, the Muslims themselves, the Shias themselves. So we have to be careful that we don't take in the misrepresentation. That's one thing. The other thing is not taking the portrayal of an Islamic law, which is sometimes a valid and legitimate Islamic law, but it is presented in a way that it looks inhuman. It's important that we're not tricked by that. A lot of times, we take a certain perception of an Islamic law, which is an Islamic law, it is part of the Sharia, there's no misrepresentation on that front. It's not like something which is not in the Islamic law is presented as Islamic law. That doesn't happen there. But it is presented in a way where it looks fanatical, it looks inhuman, it looks illogical. And therefore, people have serious doubts with regards to it. For example, one of the issues that I have been approached in this conference, I don't know if the sisters are here that introduced that topic, we're discussing it very briefly, of course, but this is not the first time. I've been asked this question many times. And people ask it in a way as though this is not Islamic. I'm not saying the sisters last night did it, but a lot of times people have this question. It's presented in a way where, as though it's not Islamic. It's something that the Islamic Republic is doing. It's not Islamic. Why does the Islamic Republic, supposedly, like I'm not sure whether like which side to take, because on one hand, the religious people are saying, why isn't the Islamic Republic actually enforcing hijab? On the other side, you have people that are saying, why are they enforcing hijab? I'm not sure whether to accept that they are enforcing hijab or they're not enforcing hijab. There's some level of enforcement of hijab in the Islamic Republic. And this is portrayed in different ways in maybe a wider definition of the word media, including books. The way it's made to seem, it's a very scary thing. Why? It doesn't make sense. Why are you enforcing hijab? People should have the freedom. The logic of that we can discuss, we can have discussions on, but first we need to realize that actually it's an Islamic law. It's not something that was created by one particular scholar in the 20th century. It's something that's all over our books. Since this is an academic setting, this whole topic is not one of those lectures that we would sit together and try to inspire each other in something spiritual, whatever. This is very exciting. Another example I remember is that they say, oh, why is Imam Khomeini's, this is a very difficult rule to explain. I'm opening up a huge can of worms. Okay, but I want you guys, I want us to be able to move towards understanding. And that's challenging. We have to hear things, we have to process them, understand them. They say, why did Imam Khomeini believe that girls under the age of 9 even can be married off, and there can be lustful relationships between the husband and that girl, whatever age the husband is, whether it's a similar age or an older age. Technically, according to what they find in the Wasila, I don't know if you've heard that one before, but a lot of people have. On the point that I'm trying to make right now, it is presented in a way as though, oh my God, you know, this is disgusting. How can this be Islamic? What the heck was Imam Khomeini thinking when he said this? Well, brothers and sisters, what you need to know firsthand, you got to think about this and come to understanding. But this is not something Imam Khomeini came up with. It's used as a political tool. The fact is, it's in all Islams throughout history. Not even only Shia. This is an Islamic principle. Why isn't there? It's a good discussion. Let's discuss that. But the first step is to know it's there. Okay. It's not being made up. But the way it's presented, Muslims take an apologetic stance. Like, oh, how can this be Islamic? No, 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 this can't be Islamic. All the scholars throughout history could have made and they said, well, they're definitely wrong about this. Well, did the Ahlul Bayt also make a mistake? The Holy Prophet also make a mistake? The evidence is overwhelming. Let's go and try to understand it. So, when this is presented in the media, sometimes it is giving something which is actually not part of the Sharia as something that is part of Sharia. We got to be careful with that. Our understanding of the Sharia is going to help us. And sometimes something which is part of the Sharia, it is portrayed in a way that is, first of all, not practiced by Muslims in that way. It's portrayed in a way where it just does not sound logical at all. There's the fact is that that law exists within Islam. This is why I feel that this is a very important topic and discussion for us especially. The subtopics I have here. Number one, what is the purpose and significance of the Sharia in the Islamic framework? How important is it? What's the purpose? And what's the significance of it? How important is it? With regards to the purpose of the Sharia, there's a famous saying that Imam Khomeini has, and possibly other scholars have, whether they have it or not, that's the fact about the Sharia. Or something that is sometimes referred to as fiqh jurisprudence. There is a distinction between the two, I'm going to get to that. But many times, what is meant by fiqh is the Sharia, and what is meant by the Sharia is fiqh. We will differentiate between those two concepts to be a bit more accurate. But for now, the comment that Imam Khomeini made was with regards to the word fiqh, but what he means is the Sharia. He said fiqh is the practical philosophy of Islam. I need to elaborate on that. What does that mean? In philosophy, which we were discussing yesterday, which included in the old ages, during the time of Aristotle and others, philosophy included all disciplines that are studied in universities and in seminaries. Well, most of, I should say to be more accurate, what is studied in universities and in seminaries was included in that. They divided up philosophy into theoretical philosophy and practical philosophy. Theoretical philosophy included various discussions such as physics, medicine, logic, what we call philosophy today, and so on and so forth. And the practical philosophy included ethics, political sciences, and other areas. So the practical philosophy basically talks about practice, talks about what needs to be done, as opposed to theoretical philosophy that tries to describe what is and what is not. Okay. So theoretical philosophy focuses on what is and what is not, and practical focuses on what should be done and what should not be done. When he terms this as fiqh being the practical philosophy of Islam, he's trying to tell us that within Islam, there are certain discussions that have to do with our understanding of the universe, our understanding of the cosmos, our understanding of ourselves as human beings. There's much of that. They are referred to as the ma'arif of Islam. But what involves practice, all of that, Imam Khomeini says, all of that he refers to as the fiqh, okay? The practical philosophy of Islam is the sharia. Anything that deals with practice is fiqh, is the sharia. To further explain, Islam is a religion that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent down for us as guidance. And as opposed to what a lot of us, many of us have as a wrong perception of this religion, does not deal with one area of life and not the other. It's not something which is limited. A lot of us do view Islam in this way. A lot of us do think we need to practice Islam in this way. But the fact is, Islam is not that. We have a limited understanding of Islam. Otherwise, Islam has suggestions, instructions, advice in every area of life. See, between the relationship between the human being and God, the relationship between the human being and him or herself, the relationship between the human being and his family, the relationship between the human being and the society, and that can have various shades to it, whether it's government or members of society and their relationship with one another, all of that has definition in Islam. All of it. All of it has that instruction. Some of them, of course, we're not talking about obligations only. This is one area that a lot of people don't fully understand. We're not talking about obligations only. The Sharia is not just a list of wajib and haram. The Sharia includes a lot more than just wajib and haram. And the discipline that studies it is referred to as fiqh or jurisprudence. So that tells us that it's a very important discipline. It's a very important part of Islam that needs to be thoroughly understood and properly studied. Besides salawat, please. With regards to the importance of it, and hopefully while we're talking about some of the other subtopics, maybe this could be clarified a bit more as well, but one of the ways that people can measure how important, in the eyes of Islam itself, the Sharia is. There's probably many different ways you can do that. One of the ways you can measure is the volume of hadith or verses that you have. If you compare all of what we have in Islam, you have the Holy Quran, you have hadith. We'll leave the works of the scholars and all the fiqh books and all that aside. Just look at the sources of Islam, Quran and hadith. With regards to the Quran, it's not a very high percentage of verses that talk about what is referred to technically fiqh, okay, or sharia, where you have a very particular definition of a certain responsibility. Many of the verses are not like that. Of course, if we want to look at it and look at sharia the way Imam Khomeini does, yeah, you'll include more verses. But I don't want to focus on saying that there's a large volume of verses of the Holy Quran that deals with sharia. That's debatable. But when it comes to the traditions or the ahadith that we have, of the most authentic and reliable sources that we have is called Wasail al-Shia. It's not the only compilation of hadith that we have. It is one of them, one which was compiled in the 10th century after the Hijrah of the Holy Prophet. This book, the majority of the 30 volumes, according to one print and 20, and the other print, depending on what print you get, much of, arguably most of, the ahadith, the traditions we find in this book, have to do with the Sharia. So in other words, much of the time of the Ahlul Bayt was spent in telling the people about their Sharia. That tells us that this is very important. If the Ahlul Bayt, the Imams, thought that it's so important to take the precious time out and go and explain this material over and over and over to various people, different people, in different arenas of life, and that means it is very important. That's one of the ways to judge the importance. Next subtopic with the question that is raised, which is a good question, is fiqh is often viewed as a dry discipline. When I read this, I kind of laughed. The reason being, I focused on fiqh in the house as one of the few that I had a lot of interest in. I don't know why people don't have interest in it. They think it's dry. Of course, my experience of the Lebanese Shias is that they're also very interested in Ahkam. If you set up Ahkam classes even 12 a.m., there's people are going to be attending. But for a lot of people, fiqh is seen as something which is very dry. When I was one of the first students, maybe, as far as I know, that always focusing on this discipline, I can't forget that a brother that was interested in, and there's not Sheikh Farouk, by the way, it's somebody else, you wouldn't know him, that was interested in philosophy and Irfan, very bluntly told me that I don't know how you have the nerve to sit in those boring classes. A lot of people think that fiqh is very dry. I would disagree, of course, but continuing with the question, is this accurate or is the Sharia a dynamic framework for the jurisprudence of life? So basically, to put it maybe in my words, are we looking at some very boring discussion that we would, you know, try to read on some very intricate details that we don't even understand what it's all about? Or are we basically, when we talk about Sharia, we are talking about reading, a lot of people are interested in reading how to live their lives better, okay, to have a prosperous life. And they look all over the place, various books to find that out. And people usually don't think that one of the books they can pick up and read on that is the book of fiqh and practical laws of Islam. Which one is it? We're trying to say, obviously, that it's not that dry discussion. It's actually very important, and it's very, it makes a huge difference in our lives. Hopefully, we'll be able to expand on that. What I'd like to explain, based off of this question, the concept or thought that came to my mind here, is when it says, is it accurate to say that Sharia is a dynamic framework for the jurisprudence of life? For some reason, when I was reading this, I thought of explaining the distinction between Sharia and fiqh here, because it leads us to the next discussion, which I think is one of the more important discussions in the list of subtopics that I have. Is fiqh and Sharia one and the same? The answer is no, they're not one and the same. The word fiqh or tafaqquh means literally deep understanding. In the Holy Quran, the word tafaqquh is mentioned. لِيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الدِّينِ. To have tafaqquh فِي الدِّينِ. Tafaqquh فِي الدِّينِ means deep understanding of religion. It doesn't mean learning the laws only. It means deep understanding. It includes theosophy, it includes theology, it includes tafsir, it includes hadith, it includes many other disciplines within the seminaries that are discussed. One of those is the discipline that talks about the sharia. So fiqh literally doesn't even, is not even exclusive to what we call fiqh today. But getting to the more contemporary meaning of the word fiqh in the seminaries, fiqh is a discipline that tries to derive sharia. In other words, sharia is divine law. Right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us certain rules and regulations to live our lives. That is what is called sharia. That is divine. That's from Allah. Then you have fiqh. What is fiqh? Fiqh is the understanding that the jurists, through the process of jurisprudence, have in order to arrive at what the sharia is. Therefore, fiqh is the study of divine law. It's not divine law itself. Okay? So if you have scholars developing opinion with regards to the sharia, it's their understanding of divine law. It is not necessarily divine law itself. It's important for us to differentiate between the two. Fiqh is the understanding, and that's why you have differences. Right? Divine law is not different. Differences come from different understandings. That's fiqh. Sharia is the actual divine law. With that understanding, the next topic I want to introduce, and hopefully talk a few minutes. I have planned to talk 10 minutes about each of these topics, so we can at least have 10 minutes of Q&A at the end. Hope that we can do that. The next one is this. Given modern challenges, is the sharia in need of reform? Or is it a means towards reform? I think this is a very important question, a very important discussion for those that are interested in that. For those who want to, or are thinking about the future of Islam, those who are active and involved, this is a very serious question. In fact, it is not only a serious question amongst Muslims. There's a lot of non-Muslims that are very interested in this discussion. There are a lot of conferences and seminars globally held, one way or the other, related to this topic. There was one in Oxford in the UK, Rethinking Islamic Reform, a couple of years back, that was attended by, or the speakers were, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf from the United States and Tariq Ramadan, a European-born Muslim that has traveled, both of these individuals have traveled to the Sunni seminaries, studied relatively well, pretty educated about Islam. They've studied particularly jurisprudence pretty well. I have listened to the talks of Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. He's pretty well versed in that discipline. And also Tariq Ramadan. But who's attending this in Oxford University? It was interesting that there was attendance from many of the embassies of different countries, including the United States of America, that are attending this conference. It shows that this is very important to them. Of course, for the wrong reasons. When we're talking about, or when some people talk about Islamic reform, I mean, you got to reform Islam. A lot of the Muslims and Shia even today, they actually think that there needs to be reform in Islam itself. Islamic law has to be reformed. 1400 years ago, the Holy Prophet came down in a region which considered women as property And women were being inherited by their own children when the father died. And in that day and age, the Holy Prophet introduced the idea of no, women are not property, they are not inherited. They actually receive inheritance, but that inheritance is half of that of their brother, for example. Or the wife doesn't receive any inheritance from the land that the man owned, her husband owned. Like this, at that time, was very revolutionary. And it was very modern for that time. And we commend Islam for that. But in the 21st century, that's not something which is modern anymore. There's a process of change. That was one of the first steps. Now we have to change to something that is more human. Discrimination against women is not acceptable. Or the law of Islam related to traveling even. That says if you travel for 8 farsakh, 28 if I remember correctly, 28, approximately 28 miles, or if you travel 14 and a half miles and return, that's when you're going to be praying qasr, your prayers will be broken. Well, the hadith say that at that time, that distance was traveled in a whole day. They had to start in the morning to travel that distance, and they would arrive there at night time. Nowadays, that distance is traveled in less than an hour, a lot less than an hour. So, okay, that was there, but that needs to change. The rules of, or the penal law of Islam, in that part of the world, where brutality was very common, they used to have slaves, they used to cut off their ears, they used to cut their noses off. And killing was pretty easy, they used to bury alive their own daughters. In that day and age, having the capital punishment, and especially for certain crimes, like adultery, stoning the person, or burning the person, according to some narrations on homosexuality, for men, not for women. These are all acceptable in that part of the world, but today, the modern life, that's not acceptable. In that day and age, a woman leaving the house needing her husband's permission, if she's married, that's acceptable, but in this day and age, no. To say that the wife is going to rely on the work of the husband and he's supposed to provide sustenance for the family, that's just no longer the case. People work together, the wife may be making even more money. So that law needs to change. And a long list of other issues within Islam's law. These were just a few. Some people think that this needs to be reformed. Let me state the following for now, because there's two things. I want to talk about reform in the Sharia and reform in jurisprudence, in fiqh. Because the other version is, and this is also happening, some people say that no, we don't change the Sharia. But we're going to take another look. Let's revisit the proofs or the sources we have for these ahkam. And if we do that, we will realize that there's room to change that. And there's different methods that are used for that. We'll talk about both very briefly, of course. One thing which is fact before we talk about the reasoning. One thing which is fact is that Islamic Sharia doesn't change. Sorry, for those who are hoping for there to be change, it's not going to happen. Because we have very explicit statements from the Holy Prophet in the Holy Quran, in the sayings of the Ahlul Bayt. Some of which state the following: حلال محمد حلال إلى يوم القيامة وحرام حرام إلى يوم القيامة. صلى الله عليه وسلم.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Roughly translating to the idea that whatever was permissible at the time and the Holy Prophet made it lawful will remain lawful. It's not going to change until the Day of Judgment. And whatever he mentioned as being forbidden and unlawful, and that's going to remain unlawful. It's not going to change until the Day of Judgment. It doesn't even say until the coming of the Imam. It says until the Day of Judgment. There's not going to be change in that. But what I want to bring to our attention, and obviously this is a discussion that requires its own whole lecture, reform and Sharia, and how do we deal with modern challenges? Are these solutions even practical in today's day and age? For example, the examples that I mentioned, some of them may not have been too practical for people. Something which is a bit more practical. Assuming that this is Sharia, okay, because we have a difficulty here. We can only talk about Sharia to the extent of our understanding. And therefore, you have the boundaries of fiqh and sharia are blurred a bit. So what I'm going to give is the common understanding of the majority of ulama with regards to the sharia. And that is shaking hands between the opposite genders. Okay, that's something which is in the sharia. It's not allowed. When you press the malajah for it, so well, if you have gloves on, without pressing hard, you can shake hands. And people say, thank you very much. That's not really a very good solution. It's going to make things worse if you want to shake hands like that. Okay, so is this even practical in this day and age? In this part of the world, at the very least. Yeah, if we're living in Iran, that's something that's doable. But living in America is actually something that's doable. So this is a very serious discussion. But we have a very short amount of time that we're going to be dedicating to this particular topic. What I want to bring to our attention and to think is that why is it that we expect Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give His laws in accordance to the way we think our lives should be? The way we think that human prosperity will be accomplished. Are we the ones to tell God and expect and say, look, you know, back at that time, those were good in that context. Today, we have changed, so you need to change your laws for us to suit our needs. Now we want to have this relationship where both spouses work, and there's no discrimination. The husband shouldn't need the permission of the wife. In some families, actually, the husbands need the permission of leaving the house. Okay. As opposed to what Islam says, that women need to have permission. Some sisters have, I gotta commend them on that. They have a pretty good grip on their husband. But let's leave out discrimination. When people talk about a feminist approach against Islam, and they come over and say, why are some of these laws and so on? I said, look, I have studied Islamic law. I think if there's anybody that should come and protest, it should be the men. Okay. That, you know, we don't get too much in this legal system, but we have to work our tails off and serve other people according to the legal system. Anyhow, there shouldn't be any discrimination. We want to live our lives like this. I should need permission from my wife, and she should need permission from me. We just live together. I do my thing, she does her thing. So we've decided that we want to live our lives like this. We think this is prosperity. God, can we change your law, please, to suit our needs today? Is it Is that how the relationship is going to be? Or is God, as our Creator, as the one, I want to put this in, it's very philosophical and it's very deep, but it's not something that's going to be swallowed very easily or understood and comprehended very easily. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not only the Creator of the universe that has put into the framework of the universe the relationship between the sun and the earth, such that mass has gravity, okay, and the earth has to be at this very, very particular distance from the sun and orbit it in order to have the resources and the conditions and the circumstances to allow for life to exist on it, for the human being to live on earth. So it's not too cold and it's not too hot, and you get four seasons and you get to enjoy that life. Okay, He has created that relationship. He has made water the way it is and the fire the way it is, and the relationship between the two being in that way. The relationship between heat, oxygen, and fuel that ignites if it comes together. And if it doesn't come together, it's not going to ignite. You can bring fuel and oxygen together, it will not ignite. Or heat and fuel together, it will not ignite. You need oxygen there. Okay. Who determines that relationship? Why isn't it that it's fuel and heat, and instead of oxygen, some other gas? God has made that relationship. So He governs the physical world, the relationships. And we go through our sciences and discover the relationship between these different substances. And we learn that, okay, if you want to not kill yourself, then you have to be very careful when you're dealing with fuel. And the gas station, don't light a cigarette. Okay? It's very dangerous. Through the study of sciences, we learn things like that. There is a relationship, or there's relationship between human beings as well, as individuals, and then collectively as a society. The actions that people have, the interactions that people have with one another, actually and really has an impact and an effect. Some of those effects are short term, some of those effects are very long term. God is the creator of all of this, is telling us, look, I have created you in this way, that this is how that relationship should be working. If you want to be able to have a prosperous life, want to enjoy life, this is how it's going to work. If you imbalance it, it's going to ignite. You are going to catch fire, you're going to burn yourself. Don't do that. And we can see how, and the other thing that I don't understand in this whole thing is, why is modern life perceived as being such a beautiful thing? Have we resolved the problems of humanity in modern life? It was shocking when I come across some of these instances. In one of the universities in London, just a month ago, in the month of Muharram, I was over there, I went for a student body program, Dua Mubah, which is a very spiritually uplifting experience with the brothers and sisters that were present there. But then walking out of the room where we had the program, walking in the hallways, in one of the bulletin boards, whatever they're called, there's this flyer that talks about a strike. And it was saying the strike is because in that university, in Britain, which is heading BBC, that attacks every single country that they see as discriminating against women, okay? In that country, in a university that is government supported, the same job held, or that position held by a female and a male, there was, I believe, a 20% salary difference, where the woman would get 20% less for the same exact work, same hours. even for things that they say they, there's discrimination. Really? I thought you guys had resolved that problem. Is discrimination only when it comes to hijab and women should come out half naked so the men can enjoy themselves? But when it comes to payment, the same job, the woman gets 20% less? Are women really living prosperous lives? Have we been able to resolve domestic violence in non-Muslim lives in the modern world? Do you know the statistics of domestic violence against women in the United States of America compared to other countries, including Muslim countries? Sometimes they blow some of the countries, like Egypt is one of those countries, they always blow up in the media. Women are discriminated, there's violence against women, so on and so forth. Oh, there's no violence in America against women? What's the statistics? Do any of us know any of that statistics? Or just allow the media to say, oh, it's beautiful on this side, look at the half-naked women, and this is beautiful, and over there you have these women that are covered up in black abaya, and they're beaten on and so forth. Is that really the picture? How has modern life really resolved our problems? How many people are becoming more and more, of them becoming homeless in this country? Is the banking system, the economic system so great? I don't want to say there's no advancements, don't get me wrong. But at the end, this system has not resolved our problems. This is not me saying it. It's Western philosophers. There's this idea, we talked about modern philosophy. There's this idea, there's courses that are presented on it, about the modern and the postmodern, and the postmodernists. One of, or some of them are coming out and saying, look, this whole enlightenment project that happened and went through phases over a few centuries has failed. This was in the Second World War they were saying this, not today. We've not forgotten about that. Modern life does not resolve their problems. So we can't say, you know, this is a beautiful lifestyle. God, can you please change your laws so they can suit the way we want to live our lives? It doesn't work like that, brothers and sisters. God is the creator of all of this. He's telling us, look, it's your choice. I've given you the freedom. But this is how you can manage your lives as individuals, as families, between spouses, parents and children, children and parents, extended family, political life, social life. These are the rules. If you do this, it'll be paradise on earth. And believe it, the reason why some of these people, some of these scholars particularly, that are so outspoken about the importance of the Sharia, people like Imam Khomeini himself, it's because he's experienced it himself in his life. Go see these families and see what beautiful lives people can have if you just implement Islamic Sharia in your lives. People say, no, I don't want to do that. And then they love, I guess they love divorce, for example. It's one of the results. If you want to implement that, then loads of issues. So no, Islamic Sharia doesn't change. We need to change to conform with Islamic Sharia. Not Islamic Sharia change to conform with us. It doesn't work that way. What about reforming jurisprudence and fiqh? The methodologies that are used, some things that are said, the methodology that is used in fiqh and jurisprudence to try to derive law is outdated. We need to bring in certain academic methodology into all of this. I really recommend brothers and sisters who read that type of argument or have heard about it to please read a bit about Islamic jurisprudence and try to understand it first, then critique it, if you wish. It's open. One of the things that I explained yesterday as well, and we're explaining it today as well, is that nobody's afraid of being questioned. We've experienced over and over and over. Islam is so rich, there's no need to throw a fit because somebody raised a question. Oh, it's rich. Is that 10 minutes for the 60 minutes or the 70 minutes?
10 minutes before. We'll go allow the, then allow 10 more minutes for the Q&A.
Okay. It's like sometimes a person who hasn't studied law, and without studying law, I want to go and criticize the legal system. Go study it first. Go read into it. And then see if it's actually the case that there's problems there. Now, speaking as someone who has read, to a certain extent, to my limited abilities of trying to study and understand jurisprudence, it's a very, very rich, one of the richest, if not the richest, discipline in the house. Because historically, the discipline that has been focused on most has been jurisprudence throughout history. Why? It's a long story. I don't want to get into that. Scholars over the last 1,000 years plus, actually, because it started during the time of the Ahmadid for themselves, but the problem is we don't have access to those works. What we have access to are books that date back to the 4th century after the Hijrah. And we are in the 15th century. We don't have anything earlier that we have available to us, unfortunately. They date back to the 4th century, early 4th century. But it started earlier than that. Over all this time, the jurists have scrutinized the arguments and the proofs and the discussions of other scholars and developed their own opinion. So over 1,000 years plus, there's been plenty of people, I don't know if I can really put an accurate figure on them, but a large number of scholars have lived their lives to spend much of it in scrutinizing all that proof and presenting views. Sometimes one scholar writing 3 or 4 books, each time going through the adilla, going through the verses, going through the hadith, going through the works of other ulama, their understandings, and then proving why Islamic Sharia is A and not B. And the view that says it's B is actually wrong for this reason and the other reason. And sometimes one scholar would be looking at that and they wouldn't say that, oh, last time I looked at this, this was my view, that must be right. No, they revisit it again. And they looked at it again, and were like, okay, no, this needs a bit of change. Now looking at it again, it seems like this is a fallacy. This needs to change. It's actually like this. The methodology of jurisprudence and deriving law is something that has gone through change. The books that we are currently seeing coming out that are studying that change, studying the history of usul fiqh, for example. The principles of jurisprudence, as it is translated to. You go over that history, what all this has gone through to arrive at something very strong today. And even today, the ulama in Qum are not sitting down and saying, okay, you know, we have it all, now let's just use those principles, the methodology. No, that doesn't work like that. Ayatollah Sistani looks at that, he comes up with his own perspective on what the methodology should be. The way he approaches hadith is very different than, say, Ayatollah Bahjat in his approach in hadith. Their methodology is different. He has proof for why this is accurate. Ayatollah Bahjat provides his proof as to why he wants to approach hadith in that way. This scholar focuses on the Qur'an, and he has reasons for it, and he derives law in a particular way from the Qur'an. The other scholar believes that that's not the case. There's reasons why we can't use verses like that. The methodology is under scrutiny. Every year, every day, scholars are spending loads of time on this. So if the question is that needs to be reformed, it's being reformed constantly. Today, the students in the Hausa are not just taking things from their teachers and saying, okay, my teacher said this, therefore this must be fact. No, it's not the case at all. Students are deferring. Sayyid Muhammad Qadhi al-Muhammad defers with Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr in many areas. And Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, his teacher, said, Khuhi, Imam Khomeini with his teachers, Imam Khomeini's students, like Ayatollah Karim Shirazi, for example, differs in many areas with his teacher. Ayatollah Fadhil Al-Kirani also differs with his teacher. They all look at the resources available to them, the Quran, the Hadith, the proofs available, and they reform it. So yes, it does, but that's happening. I'm just making you aware that this is going on. But there's a particular framework. And I want to warn about this, because this warning is important for all of us. We say this to Hausa students for a particular reason, and that is to warn Hausa students from developing pseudo-views with regards to the Sharia. The wrong type of reform . And there's a reason why we want to give that to a general audience like this. And that is, we're seeing the names of Maraja popping up. You hear, oh, this Maraja has this view, that Maraja has that view, and so on and so forth. Living at such a great distance, not having first-hand access to the scholars, the seminary, the Maraja, people get very confused, and they can get very confused with regards to these different models. Some of them coming up with views that are very drastically different than what previous generations of scholars have come up with. And studying that, their explanations for it, I can tell you some of it at least, some of it is wrongly perceived as being unorthodox and unauthentic, but some of it is correctly labeled as such. Some very, very, very weak arguments. Sometimes the framework of fiqh is treated as a framework to study the Sharia in the sense that we set out certain principles to understand law. As long as an explanation in understanding of the Sharia is within the framework of usul al-fiqh, then it is going to be legitimate. I tend to disagree with that. There's another element which is very important. And that element is the element of idalah. The condition of idalah is a very important condition in the jurists that we would want to look up to and learn our Islam from. Again, this is a topic that will require a lot of time. I don't want to do that. All I want to state is the following, that you can use the principles of the jurisprudence and explain a view with regards to Islam that does make sense based on the rules of the principles of jurisprudence, usul al-fiqh, but it's completely wrong. You use the wrong combination of those and you reach a conclusion that, yeah, you're using those principles, but it's completely wrong. Why? Because the intention should be that we're not trying to come up with a view that can be justified with usul al-fiqh. We are trying to understand the Sharia. The Sharia actually exists. It's divine law. I need to have the sincerity of trying to understand divine law, not get too caught up with usul al-fiqh and say, okay, as long as something can be justified with usul al-fiqh, then it's legitimate. No, the intention should be to get to the Sharia with that. And that comes with idalah, with justice, with piety. Otherwise, we need to put the Jews, Bani Israel, in the end got to and arrived at. So with regards to reform, I think we spent a good amount of time on that, although it deserves a lot more than that. There are a couple of other topics as well. I'll just mention them, maybe in the Q&A, because I think we've run out of time. One is with regards to the understanding of the Sharia in a holistic spiritual framework, which is also a very interesting discussion. and expounding on the Sharia, the Tariqa, and the Haqiqa. Also, the topic of how Muslims can embrace the Sharia as means towards spiritual elevation. And lastly, how can Western Muslims reclaim the Sharia in Western society? I wanted to throw those ideas out, so maybe it'll get your minds thinking, and you can maybe benefit from comments or questions in the remainder of the time. Walhamdulillah.